These sense doors, this quote, I heard the Dalai Lama talk some kind of recorded talk that he gave. And he had this quote that this is what I think the importance of the sense doors are, why they're so important. But he says, right now, at this moment, you have a mind which is all the basic equipment you need to achieve complete happiness. There's something about that when he said that. Right now, in this moment, you have a mind which is all the basic equipment you need to achieve complete happiness. And you got to let that settle there, because what he's basically saying is you don't have to improve yourself. This practice doesn't have to be about how do I somehow improve myself and make myself better so I'll either be worthy of liberation or somehow I'll understand liberation. I'll correct all the old stuff so that, you know, I can find liberation. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is you already have it. It's already here. And I think the sense doors and beginning to practice with the sense doors is a way to come to understand that. And we can come to understand it because through the sense doors, you can begin to see how distinct these doors are from who we think we are. So on one hand, who we think we are is the person that sees and hears and tastes and smells and thinks. That's who we think we are. But on the other hand, if you actually look at the organs by which those experiences happen, they're so intricate, we don't have any control over it. We don't have any ability to control our sight or how we see and what we hear, things like that. These are all things that occur just out of the basic equipment we have as a human being. In whatever shape or form it takes on. And when you begin to see that much of what we are going to talk about from here on out comes from how we relate to these sense doors, you can begin to see that my thinking, my somehow concluding I am a certain being, a certain person, a certain type of person, this all kind of goes haywire. Our sense doors get attached to something. It gets connected to something that we're going to talk about the steps of that connection a little bit further with the contact and the feeling tones. But basically, the eye knows it's seeing, and the ears knows it's hearing. It's conscious of that. It knows it's hearing. It knows it's seeing. It knows that there is a data out there that it can pick up and conceive. I couldn't find the sutta I wanted to get. I had it for I don't know if I told you guys, but I had it for the very first intensive study course that we did. And we had this sutra that me and one of the other yogis were looking at. And it was so complicated. Basically, I think if any of you guys were in that class, it said something like, the Buddha said something about the things that the sense door can conceive, things that the sense door can pick up and conceive, and things that, so it's like smells or aromas that are happening that the sense doors can pick up and conceive, and aromas that are happening that the sense door cannot conceive. So it's sort of like, if the sense door is not conceiving it, how can you say there's a smell there? If the sense door can't see it, how could you say there's a something to be seen there? But the Buddha was saying there were things that were seeable that the sense door can't see. And I guess what I'm pointing to is that we limit ourselves so much so. If we limit ourselves to just believing the existence of the world in what we can perceive through our sense doors, as if that's it, this is all there is. This is me. Every negative thing I've ever done, every negative thing ever done to me, that's who I am. I've had a couple of good things happen, but by and large, it's been all bad. That's me. That cannot be the life that we live and expect to get anywhere near liberation. It can't be like that. And so there's something that the Buddha was pointing to that Philip Moffat said. He said that maybe, what did he say? Hold on, I got this little note here. Sometimes Philip, you know, you have to write down every single thing he says because he just gets on a roll and you're like, oh my God. He was talking about the Four Noble Truths, and he was talking about what the Buddha was going on and on and on and on and on about, on and on. Oh, I'm sorry, I got the wrong notepad here. He was going on and on and on about the Buddha, talking about the Four Noble Truths and what the Buddha might be pointing to if he's pointing to these Four Noble Truths. So let's see, where is it at here? He said maybe the Buddha was not pointing to what we consider pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Maybe he wasn't pointing to, oh, whether you should feel, whether something feels pleasant or doesn't feel pleasant or feels unpleasant. Maybe what the Buddha was pointing to is just, can you get that the realm, the place we reside in, this world, in and of itself, is difficult. It's not going to go right. There's going to be crap going. Good stuff coming, bad stuff coming. It's the realm itself. It doesn't have anything to do with your people. It doesn't have anything to do with your color, your race, whether you got money, don't have money. We know, because there's a few people that got a ton of money right now, and they're acting a little crazy. It's not the money. Clearly, it's not the money. It's not the race, because there's some people in some races that are acting a little crazy. It's not that. It's the realm that is giving us all this difficulty. And the sense doors are part of this realm. They're in the realm here, so they get attached to what they see. They get caught up in what they hear and intertwined in what we smell and taste. My son and I went to this taco truck. Oh my God, the food is so good. I can't even grasp on how people can cook that good and just be some little side truck on the side of the road. Anyway, I digress. The point I'm making is that sense doors have the possibility of freeing us. And one of the things that the Buddha pointed to was to begin to understand, to begin to ask yourself, how come just going to this truck and tasting these tacos, how come I'm so full of joy? What does that taste? These are just mechanisms of taste buds. And how come that taste brings me such joy? What is that? Where does that joy come from? That's what we want to know. It's not to say the joy is wrong, but to understand the nature of the realm we live in, we got to understand how come that taste on my taste buds gives it so much joy. When the taste buds and the mouth and the tasting is pretty mechanical to the body. But somehow that mechanic ability, somehow the seeing affects us. I mean, there are places that are dives that someone says, oh, you should go there. We should eat there. It's like a greasy spoon. And you look at the place outside and you're like, yeah, I'm not eating nothing up in there. But then if you go in and you actually eat, you're like, this is the best food ever. So how come the sight that says, no, that's not going to be good, but it's in the taste does not coincide with what we see. This is what he wanted us to begin to question. How come we get stress or distress, or how do we feel so worldly in relation to these sense doors? And then the last sort of thing that I wanted to talk about that's really the most important to me is the idea that he kind of points out through the sense doors these states of attachments that are going to begin to come. And they're going to come as we get deeper into this cycle. But he's saying that basically, we want to notice these six household states of attachment at each door. So there's six of them at each door, and there are six doors. Six states of attachment that are attached and six states that are renunciations. I mean, three attachments, three renunciations for each door. But he calls these household states of attachments. And I love that, because what he is saying is that this is the nature of being a householder. To be careful sometimes with this idea that we're striving for a monastic life, because we don't live a monastic life, and we can confuse that. And it gets really confusing if you do a lot of retreating, because you can mistakenly believe that the retreat life is, oh, that's the good life. And I'm living over here in the house and something's wrong. It isn't working. I'm all upset. When I go on retreat, I'm all wonderful and beautiful. And I'm, you know, taking care of aunts and making a way for them. But I come home and, you know, I'm just snapping at my partner. Okay, maybe you don't kick the cat, but still, you're getting close to that. And then you think, oh, I got to go on a retreat so I can get back to my true self. That is not who we are. We are householders that live in a householder realm. And if we were monastics, we would have a completely different relationship with the world and with our lives. But we are householders. And so included in householders means that we are going to get attached. These sense doors are going to get intertwined with the stimulus that's all around us. we're going, the attachment means that we get something, or the sense door acquires something, like we see a beautiful sunset. And even though you might be sitting here saying, I don't own that sunset, oh, your eyes think it owns that sunset. It's its sunset. And once it sees it, then it wants to see it again. It wants to be out there at a certain time so I can see it. It begins to take ownership of it. And then if it doesn't get to see the sunset, it gets all bummed because it didn't acquire it. And there's a way that we just sort of, the equanimous part of this whole process is having a kind of it's just the object of self of a mind. We don't even, like you don't even see your house anymore. You think it's yours. That's it. The only time you're going to get upset is if somebody breaks into it. Like, what are you doing breaking into my house? You know, this is unacceptable. There's a way in which we've so objectified some objects that we don't even see them separate from us. That's the equanimous way. That's the attachments that we get, those three, to every single sense door. And it happens, it doesn't really have anything to do with us. I'm using the word I, but that's really just colloquially, because it's not me, it's the eyes that get attached to what it sees. And then there are three renunciations, three ways of renunciating. And it's beginning to see the inconsistency in what the I think it has acquired. So the I thinks, oh, I got it. I got the sunset. And you, us, as in this human realm, the reason why we can be liberated, the reason why His Holiness said we have all the basic equipment, is because we have the capacity to see the inconsistency of whatever the I wants to grab onto and get attached to. We can see the inconsistency. We can see the movement. We can see the rising and falling. We can see the constant changing all the time. And because we can see that impermanence, then we can liberate ourselves from this grasping aspect of these sense doors. We can find a way to be liberated from it. The way to do that, this is why I'm saying that we're not trying to be in the monastic life, because the goal is not to, okay, I'm not gonna want any more beautiful sunsets. I'm not gonna see the beautiful sunset. I'm not gonna look for anything nice. I'm just gonna live in the stark bareness of reality. No kindness, no nothing. I'm not gonna look at any of it. There's a way in which some practitioners, they will say to a teacher, they'll be like, I'm just in the awareness of awareness. I'm like, what is that? Awareness. I'm just in awareness. I'm just aware of everything. That is not practice. It's an up-close realization of this, what we're doing. What are you aware of? And what is it doing to you? That sense of getting connected to it. So we're not trying to just give up everything. No more goals, no more striving, no more nothing. That's not what we're doing as householders. What this renunciation is pointing to is just noticing the impermanent, always changing nature of this realm. And if we can begin to see and find it, when we feel ourselves getting too attached to something, can I just find the impermanence? Can I find the changing nature of it? If I can begin to sense into that, then I can begin to free myself from being entwined in the expectation that it's got to be this way. Because it doesn't. It changes. And then he went one step further. This is what I really wanted to get to. Is he said, relying on this, one can abandon that. This is what we're in this dependent origination. We're in or beginning to understand that if I rely on one thing, I can abandon another thing. And what he's saying is, if you rely on the householder renunciation, you can abandon the householder attachments and transcend this kind of liberation. Transcend the limitation, I mean, of being a human being with these sensory experiences. So do you see that? If you're not relying on giving up the goal of wanting to see a beautiful sunset, that's not what we're striving for. How do I make my life as stark as possible and I don't want anything anymore ever? That's not what we're doing. We are learning to allow for that desire because we are householders. But we are always opening to the impermanent, subject to change nature of everything around us. Your apartment, your house, your family members, the pets, the furniture. It's always subject to change and it's not permanent. That's what we're relying on. And in the reliance on that, then we free ourselves from the limitations of the grasping greediness of these sense doors. This is why I think the mind, beginning to practice and seeing the mind as a sense door, is so important. Because as you see the mind as a sense door, you can begin to open to the nature of it as all other sense doors, mechanical in nature. It is always impermanent, changing. It's not stable. What the mind thinks, don't believe that. It is not always telling you the truth. In fact, often it's just making up stuff as it goes. Just making it up. I mean, out of thin air, it's making it up. This is what's going to happen. And we're scared to death thinking this is what's going to happen. It's making it up. It hasn't a clue what's going to happen in the future. It doesn't even remember all the details of some of the things that happened to us in the past, some of the drama, some of the things that we did. It doesn't remember all the details. It's just creating some story and says, okay, we're going to run with that. This is what happened last year. That's not what happened last year. If you actually sat and thought about it, talk to people that were involved, you would find out way more details than the limited little story the mind has put together to now tell you, to prove to you, yes, you really are the bad person that you always thought you were. So seeing the mind as a sense door, we can rely on renunciation, rely on the movement and changing nature of it to free ourselves, abandon this limitation of thinking the mind is me. So I'll leave you with His Holiness again. Right now, at this moment, you have a mind which is all the basic equipment you need to achieve complete happiness, not partial happiness, complete happiness right now. You don't have to do another sit. You get that? You don't have to do another meditation. Nothing. Let's sit on that for a little bit. Just think about that for a second. Oh, I love the Dhamma. All right, thank you so much. So I'm going to put us all into groups, and all of you are still here, so I'm assuming you all want to be here. And we're going to go into three people in a group. And what I'd like you to do is I'm going to watch the time, but I want you to have 3 minutes apiece and share something that you have found supportive or helpful, or that you enjoy about the feeling tones, and something that you struggle with, you don't like, you have difficulty with. So it's important that you don't give each other advice, because what I want you to do is to I'm going to give you each 3 minutes, each person shares what's important about these sense doors, and then what is not helpful, whatever word you want to use, helpful or supportive, or what do you like, what are you interested in, and what are you not so interested in, however you want to frame it, the pro and the con. And then I'm going to give you 2 minutes, and we're going to just be quiet in your group. So you can just let what you hear resonate with you. And then I'm going to give you another 6 minutes or so to kind of like just share with each other about how the whole experience was. So 3 minutes apiece. And I'll just let you know when it's time to move to the next person. So as soon as you get in the group, the biggest one is going to be figuring out who's going to go first. Anyway, let's see. I'm going to unmute you and see if anything has come from our sharing with each other. See if anybody would like to, if you have a comment or something to share.
I always have something, Tori.
Good, 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 good. Don't ever feel bad about that. Teachers,
I won't.
Something to share.
I allow a pause always. So first I said my supportive thing, which was my statistics class doesn't have to be hard, just because I said that once when I was in my sit. I was like, oh, I just... That could be like the crow flying by that I see. That could be like the song that I heard that is gone now. And so that was, and then I saw that with the struggle, as soon as I said the thing that I struggled with, which was I'm attached to the hummingbird in my backyard. And I don't want to give up the hummingbird. It's my hummingbird in my yard. And that's why those plants are there. I no longer was struggling with it. I just saw, oh, look, just like the bell, like, oh, the hummingbird. Oh yeah, I love the hummingbird. And it, then I, for a brief moment, was delighting in really letting thought just be like all the other sense stores, like the dot, like the quote, His Holiness, and I was like, okay, there's some connection between that place and just allowing thought and all the other sense doors to really just be that impermanent thing, and like delighting in it, and then, oh no, but it can't be that easy. Don't worry, it doesn't know what she's talking about. It can't be that easy. Why would we all be here? Why would we all So, and then just being like, oh, but that's one of those thoughts that's just passing by like the crow right there. Keep sitting, keep sensing, sitting, sensing, speaking. There, that's it. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. That's it. That's it. It is that easy. I mean, it's difficult for us because we've lived our whole lives attached. So we don't know how to unattach. But that, and that's what we're really working on, is how can I unattach, not be so caught up in things. But once you start relying on renunciation, the attachment will automatically begin to fall. That's what he was pointing to, that it's the relying on this, this will abandon. Good. Anyone else want to jump in here into the fray?
Where could you just say that sentence again about renunciation? Once you, again, he was saying what?
Yes, what the Buddha was saying at the end of all of his explaining about the sense doors, what he said was, relying on this, one can abandon that. And he kept saying that, relying on this, one can abandon that. And then he says, relying on renunciation in each of the householder attachments, relying on renunciation at the sense door, one can abandon the attachment. What we try to do, it sounds like in the West, is we know attachments are bad, so we try not to be attached. That's what we're trying to do. I don't, attachment is where my suffering is coming from, so I'm not going to get attached to that. But what the Buddha is saying is attachment is inherent in the realm. So if you rely on renunciation, like rely on seeing the impermanent nature of things, the changing nature of things, then the abandonment of the attachment comes on the heels of that. Mm-hmm. Rather than relying on, we kind of rely on not being attached, and that doesn't really work. We're going to get attached. There's no way around it. Gil Fronstow calls us human desirelings. He doesn't call us human beings. He calls us human desirelings. So we just desire all the time. I think I told you guys that time that His Holiness, this is my perfect example of a desiring. You can't help it. He was going to some conference in San Francisco, and he had to drive by these long tables of people selling all kinds of electronic gadgets outside his hotel or down the street from his hotel. And so for this conference, he kept driving back and forth past these little tables. And he said that by the end of the conference, he wanted one of those gadgets. He didn't even know what they were, what to do with them, but I want one of those. Whatever those things are that people are buying, I want one of those. He didn't even know how to use it, he said, but he wanted one. You know, it's like that. We can't help but desire. And especially as householders, that's what we're going to do. So we're not trying to somehow or another no longer desire, don't have goals, or I can't strive for anything because that's bad, and all of that nonsense that we project upon ourselves because we see the rules that monastics live under, and we hold the monastic life as that is the better life, that's the life we're striving for. But we don't live a monastic life, we live a householder life. So we're around a whole bunch of stuff that we have desires for. And it's not the desire, it's the not seeing the impermanent nature of it.
So Tori, I have a question about that kind of relates to that. Mm-hmm. So I feel like when I started way back and took a beginner's class with Rodney, and there was all this feeling that I had, which was to reduce the thinking, like to try to quiet the mind, right? Mm-hmm. And I really like this. It feels like a new thought to me that the mind is a sense door. That feels like it's been a great awakening. But I'm struggling a little bit with like then kind of letting it be, and instead of working towards quieting it or you know, kind of letting go of the attachment, I guess, to quieting it. And I guess I just wanted you to speak to that, kind of the like sitting back and just observing the mind and letting all that, you know, all the thoughts that come and go be. Is it makes sense to me theoretically, but I feel like sometimes it gets away from me, and then it feels like maybe that's not really very wise or useful.
Well, first of all, the mind is never quiet. It's always talking. Just like any other sense door. It doesn't stop thinking just because we meditate. It's a strange experience here, what I'm describing, but all right, let's see. When we talk about a quiet mind, what we're talking about is interest in, more than we're talking about quieting. So the more interested you get in an experience, the less you pay attention to everything else. So when you're settling into the body, which is the first foundation of mindfulness, the more you settle into the felt sense of the body, the less you pay attention to the thoughts itself. So ultimately, in deep concentration, it's not that the mind is no longer talking. It's that your attention is so on the breath, you don't care that it's talking. You're not listening to it. You're not listening to the sounds. You're not paying attention to anything. You're just right here with the breath. If you try to quiet the mind, that is a doing, and that doing is just going to stir the mind up more. So maybe every once in a while, it'll quiet down just for your sake, just to remind you that, look, I'm not quiet. So you think you're doing something. I've got it. I figured it out, and I've got it quiet. And then it'll just come right back later and just say, nah, 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 nah. So the way to quiet the mind, this idea of quieting the mind, is to pay less attention to it, to put it in the background. Put your attention on the felt sense of the breath moving, or the sense of the heaviness of the body, sitting in the chair, being here. You're putting your attention on something other than the mind's thinking. But sometimes the mind's talking and thinking is like a jackhammer that's going off outside. You can't help but hear that sound. If you hear that jackhammer and you're frustrated with it, like, I want you to be quiet, so that I can be still. So I need them to stop that construction so I can be still. Then you have aversion and you're just gonna spin in it, because in reality, you don't have any control over that sound. So the way we work with that sound is that we try to keep our attention here and let the sound just be the sound, impermanent, coming and going. It's just a sound that's moving that I don't control. It comes and goes on its own. And the more we allow that sound to just be on its own, then the less aversion we have towards it, because the less needing to control it that we end up have. It's not that we all of a sudden like the sound, we just stop fighting with it because it happens to be here. It's the same way with the mind. When the mind is not really big, it doesn't have a lot of loud talking, we can focus on the breath and we think the mind is quiet. It's still talking back there. It's still saying, running things and talking about things. We just don't care. But when it gets big, some big story, it can consume us and we can get taken out of the body into the mind. And we think the mind, I got to get this mind to stop. But what you're trying to do is settle into the body and just let the mind just come and go. It's not anything. It's not, the proliferation of it only happens when we get caught up in it. That's what the whole rain, little, whatever that thing is called, you know, that's what it's for. It's to help you not identify with what the mind is saying and just stay with your attention in the body. And eventually the mind will quiet down, just like all sounds begin to quiet down when you stop paying attention to them. See what I'm saying? All of a sudden the breath gets so big because we're so paying attention to it. But it's not bigger than anything else. It's just that this is where our attention happens to be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks.
So the quieting the mind is not you quieting the mind. It's just you giving it less attention.
I think that's where I was getting caught up in it, because like when I focus on a sense door, I focus on those sounds, right? Like I'm letting them come and go, whatever. And so now I feel like I've been focusing on the mind, and sometimes that becomes distracting and not helpful.
That's because you're going up in the thoughts with it instead of staying down in the body.
Yeah.
Good.
Thanks.
One more thing, Dara. The reason why this is important, this is for everybody, I guess, really, is because stillness is possible in the midst of chaos, but you won't know that stillness is possible in the midst of chaos if you're always looking for it to be quiet in order for me to be still. Mm. But the stillness has nothing to do with the chaos. It has to do with whether or not you have the ability to steady the mind internally in the body versus getting caught in the chaos going on around. And it takes practice to not get pulled out by the chaos that's going all around. And the more you practice with it, the less you get caught. So chaos can be going all around and you're very still on the inside. You can be running around taking care of that chaos and you're still very still, because your stillness is here inside, not outside. It's not related to the quieting so much of the sense doors. And when we go on retreat and they tell us, guard your sense doors, they're not saying, don't let any sounds and lights come in. What they're saying is keep coming back internally so that you don't get caught. You won't spin out grasping after. I mean, the retreat centers, they basically try to limit any sensory kind of overload. But even still, the stiller you get at a retreat, the more, you know, the slightest tiny little smell, you're so sensitive. You can smell and taste and everything gets bigger. So the guarding is really just come inside, come inside, come inside. The deeper you're inside, the less you're distracted by outside stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
I read something a while ago about outcomes of children who were orphaned by the earthquake in India. Mm-hmm. And there was like a research study for Buddhist children versus other denomination children, Christian or Hindu children. And the Buddhist children had these better trauma outcomes, not because their circumstances were any different. They lost their homes and they lost their families, just like the other children. But I think because of what you're saying, just the concept that what happened was what happened without there being stories behind it, with just like kind of the accepting nature of what had happened to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they were raised, if their parents shared that understanding, you could begin to see it as part of it. It would make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that helps me think about just not trying to change what's happening, even if what's happening is painful. It's just what's happening.
Yeah, it's just what's happening. And the more we can learn to just be with what is offered to us, we can accept whatever is being offered to us, the more we have the capacity to learn to discern what's the appropriate response in this moment. But mostly we don't know how to discern that because we're using the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral as the thing to determine whether or not we like whatever's happening in the present moment. But the problem with that usage of that is that pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral kind of qualifier that comes from the mind is based on our past understandings. It's not based on what's happening right now. It's based on the mind's association with whatever's happening now, with something that happened in the past. And so we want to actually begin to experience the here and now, regardless of the feeling tone, and make our determination or our discernment of the appropriate response based on now. And that's what we're, that requires that we actually connect with the here and now. As it is, let it be. See the impermanent nature of it, and then you'll find that most of the time, you don't actually have to do anything. It begins to shift and change on its own anyway.
I was, am I muted?
No, you're good. I was reading. I was reading the thing that Susie said.
Oh, sorry. I was just thinking about that and realizing that there have been just a couple times in my life where I've just been kind of in a little bit of a trauma situation, and I've caught myself sort of mentally spinning out, and because of the circumstances, just almost required it of me. I just stopped doing that. And it was surprising to me when I stopped doing that sort of mental spinning out of, oh, what's going to happen now? And then in the future, this is going to be, and this is going to be. And when I stopped that, I actually, things occurred to me about the situation as it was, that was very helpful for me to like then interact with the situation that was and be actually much more proactive about what was actually happening.
Yes.
Than the stories that my mind was spinning out with, which actually had very little to do with the present moment, but were projecting things of negative possibilities for the future. Like act of stopping that, and just attending to the present moment as it was, just fully, even though I didn't like it.
That's right.
That just totally like opened me to then act in much like it was just surprisingly appropriate ways that I didn't even know I had in me.
That's right. And I think what this ties into the sense doors is the only way to begin to see what's actually happening right now, know what's happening right now, is you got to sort of use these sense doors rather than the mind's thoughts about what's going on.
Right.
You got to use the sense doors to see, to hear, to feel what's happening right now. And then as we do that, that we can see where the mind or some thought or some sight or some sound, all of that gets attached to some old thought, some old sign, some old image that was there. And that's what makes us think that this is just like that. But we come back to the sense door of the present moment and allow for that impermanence to come to show itself. And then we can begin to see a way to free ourselves or unhook ourselves from the old thinking. Does anyone have anything else before? I want to go back to Dara's question for a moment, because I've had a thought. Rodney was really good about this, and I'm not very good about it, but Rodney was really good about this. He always provided space for the place that our minds were actually at. And I always talk from the place our minds are going. And that's a good thing in some respects. But I do have to pull back sometimes and recognize where our minds are actually at. So, as part of the Satipatthana and as part of the Anapanasati Sutta, both of those sutras advocate for the deliberate stilling of the mind, calming the mind. I don't know about quieting the mind, but calming the mind, calming the body, calming the mind, calming the body, as a mantra, as to help in the beginning, the settling down into the body. So Rodney, I could see where he would point to calming the mind as a way of settling down into the body, and not necessarily in quieting the mind, but this calming might I could see where calming and quieting the mind would be the same thing. Just this an intentional calming the mind, like soothing a baby that needs to go to sleep. But ultimately, where we're going is that we're going to keep our attention focused on one thing, and we won't necessarily be pulled out by the mind. Great. I think that was good. We should probably end here. We don't really have announcements tonight, but someone asked me to talk a little bit about gratitude, just because we have these gratitude buddies, and Tim wanted me to make an announcement that we're going to have, to not to forget about the affinity groups that we're going to start up. So if anybody's interested in joining an affinity group that we're going to start and begin to work on seeing if we can bring out some more diversity and some of the cultural differences that exist amongst us without, just to begin to have this conversation, because it's going to take a long time, but we got to start having a conversation somewhere. And so if you're interested in joining an affinity group, then just email Tim Gayo at tim.gayo@seattleinsight.org. And then someone asked me about these gratitude, or how do you practice gratitude if you're with a gratitude buddy? And the way I think of practicing this sense of being grateful is in the evening. I do it from Trumpa Rinpoche, who, not Trumpa, but Jumpa. He wrote a book called Fearless Heart. It was probably the best book I've ever read on compassion. And he, Capitol Hill Group, we used that group, that book one time. And we read a chapter in gratitude. And he suggested that you say three things you're grateful for every night, even if it's the same three things every night. But the way he pointed to gratefulness is things that you didn't it's almost like a grace, like a thing that you didn't earn, but you received. So it doesn't have to be like, oh, somebody gave me money and I didn't earn it. It's not that. It could be just the realization that someone gave you a smile out of the blue, or someone, or you woke up in the morning, you didn't have anything to do with it. Things that didn't come necessarily from your control. Or you could be grateful for the fact that you have a place to stay. And you might think, oh, well, I control, I have all the control. I have a job, I got this apartment. But the apartment complex or the person that sold you the place or whatever, you didn't have control over them saying, yes, you can come. So there's a way in which you appreciate that which you have with this recognition that you don't control everything that you have. And you begin to look at things that you, or maybe notice things that you're glad that you have this because you recognize what it would be like if you didn't have it. You can think about that. So if I have a job, I'm glad I have a job because I can imagine what it would be like if I didn't have one. Things like that. And you just think, the way he taught us was every night you think of three things you're grateful for. A gratitude buddy then would be the person you would share those three things with. It would help remind you to remember to be grateful. The book was Fearless Heart. It's His Holiness's old interpreter, Jumpa. I can't remember his first name. So anyway, I better let you go. Don't forget about giving Donna. It's very important. It's not important to give Donna because you have to give money. It's important to give Donna because this is a period of time where everything about you is saying there's not enough, there's not enough, there's not enough. Mm. But generosity is the only way to overcome that that sense of it's not enough, it's not enough, it's not enough. And so practicing generosity, whatever the amount is your own choice, but making sure that you practice generosity so you don't fall into the trap of fearing that there's not enough. All right? Great. So I think that's it, good people. I will not see you. Oh, yeah, that's it. Tupten Jempa, that's the book. I will not see you for a couple of months. In August, I come back. And then I have a long stretch, August, September, and October. By then, you'll all be close to enlightenment. And I'll just finish it round the corner and take us, just send us all in that last little bit. All right, I'll see you. Bye-bye.